Okay. As we start the class, I want to make sure everybody's got a copy of this as they want it. Remember that slide I showed of the idolatry back in Israel? I'm back, and the ladies dancing before the little idol. Some in the evening class wanted it, a few, so I made a bunch of copies. Anyone want a copy of that here? One, two. Why don't you come up and get them here? And let's see, the ladies in back. Did you want some back there? There's four, five, a couple more. Okay, how about this side? Okay, I see I'm going to have to make it for the night class again. Okay, here's...
First come, first serve,
yeah. Any more? Okay, yeah, pays to be in the morning sometimes. Yes, okay. All right, well, I've got a few. There's only a few in the night class. Maybe that's enough. Okay, anyone else? Okay, great. Everyone got it that wanted it? All right. Also, let's see, people requested more copies of Millennial Mount Zion. Did anyone need this chart at all? The top of Mount Zion in the kingdom. Anyone else want this? Everybody got it okay? I don't remember if I gave this out last week or not. If you think you need it, feel free to grab one here. If you just want a supplementary one for each section. I don't necessarily redo here. Why don't you pass that back? I don't necessarily do them every time for every minor prophet, even though they might cover the same material. Okay, everybody got it that's happy with it? Okay, and the night class beat you guys to it, too. They wanted a copy of the map of showing Israel's boundaries in the Messianic Kingdom superimposed over modern... over the modern state, so I've done this for you. So this everybody gets a copy of this. So, okay, I can see this is making a hit. Okay, so grab a copy of that. And these are approximate boundaries. Remember, this is a work in progress. So don't go to the wall for this boundary, okay? Don't go to the wall. If somebody disagrees with you, I won't go to the wall if somebody disagrees with me. This is a work in progress. And people feel differently about it. We'll know exactly what the boundaries are when we get there. Right? Okay. Everybody got one? All right. Here comes some extras. Did you take enough? You got one. Okay. All righty. So this is a switch. Normally it's you guys that ask for it, and the night class gets it first. It was reversed last week. They asked for it, but you get it first. All righty. I think that's the details. All right, let's take a look at where we were now. We were in the book of Micah. We had just started section 3, the third and final major section of the book, on page 169, God's controversy with Israel. And as we start chapter 6, we're back in a courtroom, right? Remember that? We started off the book in a courtroom. And I'll throw up the time frames here. We started off the book in a courtroom, correct? Looking at Israel's pathetic present condition and seeing that there would be a near judgment of that sinful and pathetic position. But then we also jumped into the future, and we looked at the second coming, the Messianic kingdom, the tribulation period. And now we are in the time of Jacob's trouble as we're finishing up the book. And we're back in a courtroom again. We had a courtroom in Micah's day, and the whole point of having the courtroom scene at the beginning of the book is to point out that the same thing is going to be true toward the end of the age. Israel is going to be in a pathetic moral condition again, and God is going to have a controversy with us. Okay, so we're in a courtroom, and a number of people speak. In page 169, with verses 1 and 2, the prophet started off with a call to judgment. And then the Lord came forward in verses 3 through 5, presenting a challenge to his case. You know, what are my shortcomings, Israel? I've given you, I've showered love and grace upon you. Why have you turned your back on me? Then the people responded in verses 6 and 7 by basically admitting the guilt, but also showing that they were ignorant of how to regain a proper relationship with God. It wasn't in outward external actions. And God told us what he requires. Micah 6:8. Not sacrifice with iniquity, but sacrifice and faith. Establish justice, love kindness, walk humbly with your God. That very famous section in verse 8. And then we came to the verdict in verses 9 through 16. The Lord pronounced his verdict upon Israel that judgment would come. And now we turn to chapter 7. We're coming to chapter 7 now. We're in the middle of page 172 in your exegetical outline notes. Point B in the middle of the page, the judgment in force, chapter 7, verses 1 through 6. Okay? Again, still in the tribulation period. The prophet is speaking on behalf of the faithful remnant, you can see there, during the tribulation. And he begins in verse 1 with a lamentation. Chapter 7, verse 1. Woe is me, for I'm like the fruit pickers, like the grape gatherers. There's not a cluster of grapes to eat, or a first ripe fig which I crave. So the prophet speaks, and he says in point A there that he feels like he's out in a field looking for fruit, but it's gone. It's gone. I can't find anything. So I'm disappointed. In fact, and of course, in his case, he feels a deep emotional anguish for the judgment that's going to come upon his people. There's no spiritual fruit for God. There's no very little physical fruit either. So all the fruit's gone. Now, point B, he remarks about the first ripe fig, and that was a special delicacy, the fig that ripened very early in the spring, very sweet and soft and tender. And there's a number of cross-references there. In Isaiah 28:4, Isaiah points out that that first ripe fig was eagerly sought out, quick to be harvested and eaten. Disappeared real quickly. And Israel is illustrated in Hosea 9 and 10 as a first ripe fig. But it's gone. Micah is disappointed. He's helpless. He knows that judgment is going to come. There's nothing to stop it. Page 173, he goes into the reasons for his lamentation, for this agony of his soul, for this barrenness, this helplessness that he feels. First part of verse 2. The godly person has perished from the land. There is no upright person among men. So point A, the godly has been removed from the earth. No upright person, note he says there, among men. And the Hebrew there is the word chassid, which means basically to practice good deeds. It means to be kind, to be pious, to be a holy one, to be a saint. So it speaks of the character of the person. They're kind. They live righteously. They're pious. They fear God. And they express that attitude of their heart through the practice of good deeds.
So this is the Hasidic.
This is where the Chassid gets his name. Yeah, the Hasidic Jew. They consider themselves the pious ones. Okay, we're the Chassids. So they're the ultra-Orthodox that you see with the distinctive dress. Now, Dr. Fruchtenbaum sees in the first part of verse 7 an implication of the rapture. He feels that there are implications of the rapture in the Hebrew Scriptures, and this is where he feels there is one. So it is possible. So he has it down there in the notes. And so this would be the lament of a Jewish person after the rapture, if indeed that's what's being implied here. And there are a number of verses in Scripture that repeat the idea that there is not a single righteous person on the earth. Taking that idea very literally and very completely, the only time that there would be no upright person, period, at all among mankind would be immediately after the rapture, when all those who are righteous in Christ are gone. So if we take these verses very literally and very straightforwardly, that is a possible indicator that the rapture has occurred. And this is in between where the church is gone, all the believers are gone, and those that are on the earth have not yet quite placed their faith in Yeshua. Short time. So that's a possibility. Keep that in mind there. Implication of the rapture, point C. Point D, the fruit that he's looking for in chapter 7, verse 1, woe is me, I'm like a fruit picker looking for fruit, it's all gone, would be the godly ones, the chassids here of chapter 7, verse 2, first part of the verse. The godly would be the delicious fruit that Micah is looking for, or that a Jewish person might be looking for after the rapture. So that would be a tie in there as well. But if this is the case, they're all gone. They're all gone. So no matter whether that speaks of the rapture or not, the earth is in a terrible spiritual condition here during the tribulation. Tremendous wickedness. And that's the point on point three there, the corruption of the people. Second part of verse 2, the general corruption that we see among mankind. All of them lie in wait for bloodshed. Each one of them hunts each other with a net. So that's the wickedness left behind. And the emphasis of mankind there is on violence and abuse. The bloodshed is violence. Then they hunt each other down with a net. Abuse of all kinds. Just looking for any opportunity to trap and abuse their neighbor. So the tribulation will not be a great time to be alive. And this is why God's wrath is poured out during the tribulation period. Please remember, the tribulation period is God's wrath being poured out on the world. On the world. It's not just a bad time. It's more than that. It's God's wrath being poured out on the world. So there's general corruption in chapter 7, verse 2. And there's legal corruption in verse 3. Concerning evil, both hands do it well. The prince asks also the judge for a bribe. And a great man speaks the desire of his soul, and they weave it together. So the civil leaders ask for false verdicts that will support whatever they want. And the judge says, well, if you grease my palm, give me a little bakshish, give me a little bribe, you'll get what you want. And so for a bribe, he decrees his judgment that the civil leader would like. The rich man, or the great man, is influential, wealthy person. They do what they want because they have the resources to do what they want and get away with it. They can turn the legal system to their advantage however they want. And point five there, they note, they weave it together. The Hebrew word there is chut. They bind it together. It's like being bound up together, like threads bound up in cloth, woven together in cloth. They're all in accord in this conspiracy. They're all linked together. They can't. There's no way they could get out of it. They're all integrally linked together, like a piece of cloth woven together. And the last first part of verse 4, the best of them is like a briar, the most upright like a thorn hedge. There's a great word picture for us of God's view of mankind and Israel during the tribulation. Dr. Fruchtenbaum puts down there, the most moral of them is still a stinker. That's not exactly the word picture used there. The word picture there is the briar, of course, and the thorn hedge. To God, the very best of mankind is prickly and painful and ensnaring. The very best of mankind is prickly and painful and ensnaring, and you don't want anything to do with them. You know, you keep your hands away from that rose bush that's got those sharp little spines on it, or that thorn bush. And by the way, those thorn bushes in Israel have long, long, sharp spikes that'll really do you in. They'll go into your hand. You know, they're really bad. Question. Yeah, the world will not, easily produce for mankind, yeah. But yeah, those thorn bushes in Israel are, they're the great hedges. You can't get through them, and that's the whole point here. It's like coming up to a thorn hedge, and you can't get through it because it's so painful and thickly woven. And those thorns are about an inch long, and they are razor sharp and very strong. So you stay away from them. So that's the God's evaluation of mankind and Israel during the tribulation period there. That's the best of them, verse 4. Okay, page 174, we come to a declaration. Last part of verse 4, a declaration. Now the NASB, which I'm reading from, has kind of a poor rendering of this, but I'll read it and then I'll share with you what I think is a better, probably a little better rendering of the Hebrew there. Okay, verse 4, second part of the verse. The day when you post your watchmen, your punishment will come. Then their confusion will occur. The ASV and the New King James, I think, do a little better. Here's the American Standard Version. The best of them is like a briar. The most upright is worse than a thorn hedge. The day of your watchman, even thy visitation, is come. Now shall be their perplexity. The day of thy watchman, even thy visitation, has come. And I think that's a better rendering because I think it's a reference to the prophets, like Dr. Fruchtenbaum says here. The watchman is a reference to the true prophets, the watchmen of the past, those who have been warning Israel of danger, as in Isaiah 21 there and Ezekiel 33, your cross-references. The prophets have been warning Israel of this, warning of the time when the visitation would come. And here it is, point B. What the prophets predicted is here. The tribulation, the time of Jacob's trouble, is upon us. Question. Yeah, the day of thy punishment is come. That would be the tribulation, I think. The updated NASB has what?
Punishment.
Punishment, okay. I guess I have punishment. And that's fine. It's, I think the clearer section is the day when you post your watchman. I think the other one is on the day of thy watchman, even thy visitation. You know, the day that they were talking about, not posting them, but the day that they're talking about, the day of punishment is here. The warning is about to be fulfilled.
Could you clarify, so everybody's corrupted and nobody is good, there's still some good prophets left? What am I missing out
on? In which verse?
The one you just gave.
Verse 4? No, he's saying, the warning that you've been receiving over the centuries from the prophets is finally here. This has been coming down for centuries to Israel. Warnings of the tribulation. It's now here. Okay? That make sense? Am I doing it clearly? Okay? Alrighty. So the tribulation is upon Israel. And then we move into point 5 on page 174. And we see that before we saw that there was corruption first of all, general corruption in verse 2, legal corruption in verse 3, and now we see there's family corruption, or corruption in relationships in verses 5 and 6. Again, this is during the tribulation period, verse 5. Do not trust in a neighbor. Do not have confidence in a friend. From her who lies in your bosom, guard your lips. And see, the distrust here works from the far relationship to the near relationship. The far relationship is point two there, your neighbor. Far relationship, someone who's in the street, just someone, an acquaintance that you can come in contact with. But then, point three, don't trust your best friend. Now, this is a very close relationship. The Hebrew word there, aluf, a confidant, your best buddy, someone who you would share your secrets with. Don't trust him. Don't trust the guy in the street. Don't trust your best buddy. And point four, don't even trust your wife. Okay, the secrets revealed during the most private, intimate time of your life can be revealed. This is the closest of human relationships. During the tribulation, you don't trust anybody. Not even your wife. Then in verse 6, he picks up that idea of disunity in the family during the tribulation period. Verse 6, for a son treats his father contemptuously. A daughter rises up against her mother. Daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. A man's enemies are the men of his own household. So there'll be a tremendous change in the very tight-knit, close-knit Jewish family structure. You know, the Jewish family structure is known to be very, very close-knit and supportive. You even see ads in it, in Jewish newspapers and etc. All Israel's one. We're to take care of each other. I think we're going to touch on that in just a moment here. Yeah. So in the tribulation, even the close-knit Jewish family structure is going to break down. It's going to break down. And this is a prophecy, point two there, of the Messiah for the future. It hasn't occurred yet. But Yeshua said, this is what's going to happen in the future. And for example, Matthew 10, 34 through 36. Matthew 10, 34 through 36, Yeshua says, do not think that I came to bring peace on the earth. I did not come to bring peace, but a sword. For I came to set a man against his father, and a daughter against her mother, and a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. And an enemy, and a man's enemies will be the members of his own household. He predicted this is what's going to happen. Well, there is a present day application to the Jewish believer that when a Jewish person accepts Yeshua, he usually gets, very often he gets kicked out of his family. There's a breakup in the family relationship there over Yeshua. That's not widespread because only 1% of us are believers. And it isn't as severe today as it has been, say, 50 years ago. So there's an application there. But this is basically speaking about the tribulation period. That's when it's really going to break down. Question? Yeah, that's not unique. Yeah, it's not unique to have your family, if you're a Muslim, to get kicked out, or if you're a Shinto in Japan, to get kicked out. Yeah, or a Catholic, yeah. Right, so there is an application in that sense. But again, when you look at the Jewish community, we're only 1%. 99% of the Jewish community is still, the relationships are still pretty tight. This is a breakdown in general in the Jewish family. Hang on just a second. Pauline, did you have a comment?
I was just going to say, among Christians, it's the same. You know, you come out of a Catholic religion and you become a Christian, the family thinks you're crazy.
Right, yeah, yeah. So yeah, it's this idea that you've abandoned us. You're betraying us. David. Yeah, we can see when the prophecy will be fulfilled, but there's principles that take place, yeah. So we have in Matthew 10, this is going to be a result of his coming and Israel's rejection of his coming, because the tribulation, all that works itself out to the point, see, it's the tribulation. One of the reasons for the tribulation is to bring Israel to her knees so that we'll call on Yeshua to return. So because he came and presented himself as our Messiah and rejected him, one of the outworkings of that, 2,000 years down the road, is going to be this breakdown in the family structure. And it's going to happen, especially during the tribulation. Also, in the ministry of the Messiah, I mean, in the ministry of Malachi, this is what Malachi is going to come and rectify in Malachi 4, 5, and 6. Remember, there are two comings of the Messiah. There are two forerunners. John the Baptist was the forerunner of the first coming, and Elijah is the forerunner of the second coming. Two forerunners, two comings of Messiah, two forerunners. So that basically is the relationship between John the Baptist and Elijah the prophet. But here we go. When Elijah comes, behold, I am going to send you Elijah the prophet before the coming of the great and terrible day of the Lord. That's the tribulation period. Just before that, Elijah will come on the scene. Will he come on the scene at our Passover this year or next year in the spring? That'd be nice, huh? Out of here. Now, that's not that I want the tribulation to come upon the Jewish community. I don't want that. But it's God's will, and we have to pray, your kingdom come, your will be done. You know, it's his program, and we have to get in touch with it. And we have to reach out to the Jewish community and the world today in order to snatch people from that. But I do want to see his kingdom come. And what will Elijah do? He will restore the hearts of the fathers to their children, and the hearts of the children to their fathers, lest they come and smite the land with a curse. Did you ever wonder why Elijah would have a family ministry when he's going to return? Why in the world would he return just before the tribulation to have a family ministry? Because of the breakup in the Jewish family at the beginning of the tribulation period. So he's going to be coming. He's going to have a great ministry that'll be helping. He'll be part of the glue to help the Jewish community together. Cohesive kind of glue. Question?
Is that referring to Elijah the person?
Yes, I believe Elijah the prophet will literally and physically return. I don't believe so, no. Elijah is not one of the two witnesses, no. Oh, yeah. In Footsteps of the Messiah, Arnold does not feel that Elijah is one of the two witnesses. Okay, neither do I. The two witnesses are just two Jewish men who are raised up to be the witnesses and prophets during the tribulation. Elijah will be there, too. Elijah will be there, too, and the 144,000 will be there, too. So no, I don't. A lot of people think it's going to be Elijah and Moses, or because they didn't die, but that's pure speculation. Or what are some of the other positions? Anyone think of them? Elijah and Moses, or Enoch? Yeah, Enoch. Enoch and Elijah. Yeah, that's it. I don't see any reason to go for that myself. We know Elijah will be there, and then there'll be the two witnesses as well. Okay, is that clear? Did I confuse anybody there? Okay, so Elijah is going to have it's going to be a Focus on the Family ministry there, okay? And believe me, it'll probably be bigger than Focus on the Family is, okay? So that's Elijah will come back to proclaim the Messiah and help the Jewish family hold together during the tribulation period. Okay, page 175. As we look at the top of page 175, we come to point C. There will be hope during the judgment. And here the prophet is speaking for the faithful remnant. There'll be two hopes and two messages. Two hopes and two messages explained here. The first hope is salvation, verse 7. But as for me, I will watch expectantly for the Lord. I will wait for the God of my salvation. My God will hear me. So the faithful remnant exercises their faith here during the tribulation. Those Jewish people that do come to faith through the ministry of the 144,000, etc. There will be a faithful remnant who will cling on to the Lord there. Following that, there's a message for the enemy. You know, my God will hear me. Do not rejoice over me, verse 8. Do not rejoice over me, O my enemy. Though I fall, I will rise. Though I dwell in darkness, the Lord is a light for me. And so this is a reference to all of Israel's enemies, and this will be every nation of the world, including the United States. All of Israel's enemies will be gathered to destroy her. And the warning here is don't rejoice, because the Jewish people will not be snuffed out. Light will come in the darkness of the tribulation. And of course, we've seen this pattern over and over again as we've gone through the minor prophets. So we have salvation and a warning. Then the second hope is a message of deliverance. Salvation and deliverance, of course, are two thoughts going closely together, closely linked. Verse 9, I will bear the indignation of the Lord because I have sinned against him until he pleads my case and executes justice for me. He will bring me out of the light. I will see his righteousness. And so the faithful remnant finally see what we're denying today. Today, the rabbis teach that all Israel has a share in the world to come. Not to vary. You're born Jewish, you'll be in the kingdom. But now we see we have a need. We see that there's a responsibility for sin. So that's point A. We'll bear that sin. That's a responsible decision to say, I will accept the consequences of my wrong. You know, every one of us has to do that kind of a thing. We have to say, okay, this is the consequences. I accept it. I will live with it. And so Israel finally says that. But we have hope there. Point B, this judgment is going to pass and deliverance will come. I'll plead my case. Judgment will be executed, but I will point C there, behold his righteousness. That's the second coming. That's the Shekinah glory of the Lord appearing in the sky. So Israel has faith that they will see the Messiah come. Question.
As best I understand what Mike is saying to us right now, there's going to be this interval after the rapture. There will be the interval where individual, maybe Jewish people will begin to see the light. Maybe they've had contact. Maybe they see it. And so this is taking place when 144,000 start to preach, and then the middle of the tribulation is where the whole group of people go to Petra.
Right.
Is that
correct.
What we're
Yes, yes.
Throughout the world, a Jewish remnant.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, the 144,000 probably get saved very early on, begin their ministry, and their ministry reaches to the leadership of Israel, which will finally cause the remnant to return to the Lord at the very end. Yeah, okay. All right, so there is faith being expressed here. Then we have a second message to the enemy. And at this point, as we get into verse 10, right here, we begin to move into the second coming. We're in the tribulation here, and in verse 10, we move into the second coming. And with a warning, again, another message to the enemy. Verse 10. Then my enemy will see, and shame will cover her who said to me, "Where is the Lord your God?" My eyes will look to her. At that time, she will be trampled down like mire in the streets. So the reference to her here is a reference to Israel's enemies. And the enemy is going to be ashamed. You know, they taunted the Jewish people, "Where's your God?" Psalm 79:10. And Israel's God answers, "Here I am. Here I am." And the enemy is destroyed. And notice this idea of trampling again. We've come across this imagery of trampling before, and that was in relation to what? The wine press, remember? The wine press of Almighty God, the armies of the Antichrist in the wine press as God treads the wine press from Basra, Petra, back to Jerusalem. But here, that same idea of trampling is brought out, but now the picture is mud. You know, as the way you stomp through mud in the streets, that's the way the enemy of Israel will be treated. Just like mud in the streets that you walk over. And now we move into verses 11 through 20, there's the second coming in verse 10. In verses 11 through 20, we move into the Messianic Kingdom on your time frames chart here. We move into the Messianic Kingdom with the promise of restoration. And here the Lord is speaking. He's responding to this expression of faith and hope and salvation that the Jewish community is expressing. He responds. The restoration begins in verse 11. It will be a day for building your walls. On that day, your boundary will be extended. And his reference here basically will be to Jerusalem, the building of the walls, because Jerusalem, remember, will be devastated during the middle of the tribulation. So Jerusalem will be rebuilt. And remember, when we looked at Israel and the Messianic Kingdom, we saw that in Millennial Mount Zion, Jerusalem will be a 10-mile by 10-mile city. So I was curious, and I thought, well, let's see if we can do this. So this is a map of modern Jerusalem today. It's about 8 miles by 6 miles. There's modern Jerusalem today. So I put a 10-mile by 10-mile square over Jerusalem. So that will be the size of the city, the boundaries of the city, approximately during the Messianic Kingdom. So it'll be quite a bit larger than we see right now. Quite a bit larger than we see right now. So Jerusalem will be rebuilt and judgment removed, her boundaries extended. Remember, that's Ezekiel 48, verses 30 through 35, speaks of the city enlarged to 10 miles by 10 miles. I shouldn't say 10 square miles, I should say 10 by 10. 10 miles by 10 miles. Ezekiel 48, 30 through 35. Okay, let's move on to page 176. My goal is to finish up here in 10 minutes, you guys, so see if I can do it. No, I'm not going to make it. All right, verse 12. First of all, in verse 11, Jerusalem is going to be rebuilt after being devastated in verse 11. The boundaries of Jerusalem extended, but in verse 12, there'll be a regathering from Egypt and Assyria. It will be a day when they will come to you from Assyria and from the cities of Egypt and from Egypt, even to the Euphrates, even from sea to sea and mountain to mountain. And we have a question.
In that verse, twice he uses the word Matsor, which has been translated Egypt. In verse 15, he uses Mitzrayim, which we're more used to.
Right, right. I don't know. I'd have to look into it. Yeah, I'd have to look into Matsor and see why it's a synonymous term. Good question. Good question. That's not something I've looked at. All right, I'll try to get an answer next week. Okay. Now, we have some cross-references dealing with this worldwide regathering, because you notice here in verse 12, it's from sea to sea and mountain to mountain. That's an indication that this will be a worldwide regathering. And here's some of those cross-references there in your notes. Isaiah 11:16, there will be a highway from Assyria for the remnant of his people who will be left, just as there was for Israel in the day they came up out of the land of Egypt. So just as Israel came out of Egypt, so we will come out of Assyria. Jewish people will be returned to the land. Isaiah 27, it will come about also in that day that a great trumpet will be blown. It'll sound a lot better than this one, you guys. Probably be a six-footer, huh? A great trumpet will be blown, and those who are perishing in the land of Assyria and who were scattered in the land of Egypt will come and worship the Lord in the holy mountain in Jerusalem. So we'll hear a great shofar. The word there is shofar. That will be blown, and the Jewish people will be brought home. Hosea 11:11, we looked at this at the beginning of our study many weeks ago. They will come trembling like birds from Egypt and like doves from the land of Assyria, and it will settle them in their homes, declares the Lord. And finally, when we get to Zechariah, this will be picked up again. I will bring them back from the land of Egypt and gather them from Assyria, and I will bring them into the land of Gilead and Lebanon until no room can be found for them. So we're going to fill up the land on our return. And Egypt and Assyria are picked out as two key places of the return of the Jewish people. Okay, point three, but there will be desolation. Let's see, did I miss that? Yes, but there'll be desolation before the blessing in verse 13. Just a reminder of the tribulation judgments that have to come on the planet before this. And the earth will become desolate because of her inhabitants on account of the fruit of their deeds. So there will be desolation before Israel experiences this great blessing. Probably in response to that comes a prayer of for restoration in verse 14. Israel prays for the restoration, verse 14. Shepherd your people with your scepter, the flock of your possession which dwells by itself in the woodland, in the midst of a fruitful field. Let them feed in Bashan and Gilead as in the days of old. So when Israel prays, all parts of the land are included in the prayer. All parts of the land are included in the restoration. And again, I felt the NASB was not the best rendering. And so I put it up here. It's the NASB here. And then the ASV and the New King James. Shepherd thy people, thy scepter, the flock of thy possession, which dwells by itself in the woodland, in the midst of a fruitful field. Well, Bashan literally means fruitful field. Excuse me, a Carmel literally means fruitful field. Let them feed in Bashan and Gilead as in the days of old. I think the ASV and the New King James did it better. Bring them back to the forest of Carmel. Let them feed in Bashan and Gilead. And again here, in the midst of Carmel, let them feed in Bashan and in Gilead. I think he's referring to different areas of the land. And there's this map of the boundaries of the land. Carmel is in this area here, where Mount Carmel is. Bashan is the Golan Heights. Gilead is this side of the Jordan River, the east side of the east bank of the Jordan River. So all parts of the land are included in that. I think he's saying from east to west, may your people come back and dwell in the land completely. Fill the land with your people. So that's why the notes there say Carmel in the western side of the Jordan River, Gilead on the eastern side of the Jordan River, and Bashan in the Golan. And then there's as we get to point F, I see I'm not going to make it, you guys, am I? Mac is right. Maybe I'll make you wait 5 minutes longer. Okay. As we get to point F, we have humiliation of the enemy promised. The Lord speaks in response to this prayer, in response to the faith and prayer that Israel expresses. So there will be a repetition of the miracles in Egypt in verse 15. As in the days when you come out of the land of Egypt, I will show you miracles. So God humiliated Israel's enemies in the past using miracles. The miracles brought against Pharaoh, 10 miracles against the gods of Egypt. But this time it's not one nation that's going to be humiliated by miracles, but all the nations of the world. It's much more extensive than what happened in Egypt. So there'll be a repetition of the miracles. Then the nations will be ashamed in verse 16. Here's the response. Nations will see and be ashamed, and be ashamed of all their might. They will put their hand to their mouth, their ears will be deaf. So these miracles that occur through the tribulation and through the salvation of Israel will cause the nations to shut their mouths in reverential silence. And you know, Micah's contemporary in Jerusalem. Who is that? You remember? Isaiah. Micah's contemporary had the same message in Isaiah 52. We often think of this as only a prophecy of the Messiah's first coming, but it's more than that. In Isaiah 52, 13 through 15, we read, "Behold, my servant will prosper." That's the Messiah. That's Yeshua. "He will be high and lifted up and greatly exalted." That's the second coming there. "Just as many were astonished at you, my people, so his appearance was marred more than any man." Here's the second coming. He's greatly exalted and lifted up. But in the first coming, his appearance is marred more than any man, his form more than the sons of men. "Thus he will sprinkle many nations." And the response of all that, "Kings will shut their mouths on account of him. For what they had not been told, they will see, and what they had not heard, they will understand." So when Isaiah 52 and 53 gets all worked out, this reverential awe will be expressed by all the nations of the world. In the first coming, he was marred. It's the second coming that he will be glorified. And the nations will fear in verse 17. They will lick the dust like a serpent, like reptiles of the earth. They will come trembling out of their fortresses. To the Lord our God, they will come in dread, and they will be afraid before you. They have reason to be afraid. Why? You remember why? They have great reason to be afraid. They come out for the judgment of the Gentiles in Joel chapter 3, verse 2. They come out because the basis for the judgment of the Gentiles will be anti-Semitism. Here's the remember the judgment of the Gentiles in Joel chapter 3, verse 2, and repeated in 3:12. I will gather all the nations and bring them down to the valley of Jehoshaphat. There I will enter into judgment with them on behalf of my people and my inheritance Israel, whom they have scattered among the nations, and they have divided up my land. Let the nations be aroused and come up to the valley of Jehoshaphat, for there I will sit in judgment, and sit to judge all the surrounding nations. So they're going to come trembling and in fear here. It's not going to be fun for the anti-Semitic survivors of the tribulation period. That's Matthew 21, verses 41 through 49. And he's speaking here to the goat Gentiles, the nations. Persecuted the Jewish people during the tribulation. Remember, the basis of the judgment is anti-Semitism or pro-Semitism. Then he will say to those on his left, depart from me, accursed ones, to the eternal fire, which has been prepared for the devil and his angels. For I was hungry, and you gave me nothing to drink. I was thirsty, you gave me I was hungry, you gave me nothing to eat. I was thirsty, you gave me nothing to drink. I was a stranger, and you did not invite me in. Naked, you did not clothe me. In prison, you did not visit me. Then they themselves will answer, saying, Lord, when did we see you hungry or thirsty or stranger or naked, sick or in prison, and did not take care of you? And this is a reference to the Jewish people here. Then he will answer and say to them, saying, truly I say to you, to the extent that you did not do it to one of the least of these, and remember in context, it's Yeshua's brothers, you did not do it to me. And these, the sheep, goat Gentiles, will go away to eternal punishment, but the righteous, that's the sheep Gentiles who exhibit faith in the tribulation, to eternal life. So they have reason to fear, don't they? That's Joel 3:2 and also 3:12. The Gentiles have reason to come trembling. No, this is not the great white throne judgment. This is the sheep and the goat judgments at the end of the tribulation. Okay. All righty, let's go on a little further. Let me see if I can get done here. In response to all this, we have a response of praise on page 177 in your notes. Verses 18 and 19, a response of praise. And the prophet is speaking here, verses 18 and 19. Who is a God like you who pardons iniquity and passes over the rebellious act of the remnant of his possession? He does not retain his anger forever because he delights in unchanging love. He will again have compassion on us. He will tread our iniquities underfoot. Yes, you will cast all their sins into the depths of the sea. So instead of treating all humankind like mud in the street, those who exhibit faith in God get their sins forgiven. Those who place their trust in Him and His Messiah. And who is a God like you? It's a play upon words, a play upon Micah's name, which means who is like God. And we, verse point two there, Exodus 15:11 is a similar expression. After the Exodus, we said the same thing in Exodus 15:11. Who is like, Mi kamocha ba'elim Adonai, who is like you among the gods, O Lord? A little bit of Jewish culture here. This is the verse that's the basis for the Tashlich ceremony during the High Holy Days. The Jewish people go to a body of water and empty their pockets into a body of water. Take all the dust and stuff that's in their pockets and repeat this verse. You will cast our sins into the depths of the sea during Rosh Hashanah. And what's the basis for forgiveness? The basis for this forgiveness that God is pouring out? Verse 20, "You will give truth to Jacob and unchanging love to Abraham, which you swore to our forefathers in the days of old." So the basis of all this is the Abrahamic covenant. The Abrahamic covenant. Remember that unconditional, eternal covenant that contains spiritual blessings. And the spiritual blessings expanded and detailed in the new covenant of Jeremiah 31:31. So regardless of how sinful Israel is, the Abrahamic covenant is eternal and unconditional. It will be fulfilled to Abraham. There will be a remnant that will experience the blessings of the covenant. You don't automatically are saved just because you're Jewish. You have to be a member of the faithful remnant.
So does that not disqualify being unconditional?
No. The unconditional aspect is that Abraham, the covenant cannot be broken. It will be fulfilled to Abraham. Okay?
But I do think it's deserving of an explanation.
Yes. Yeah, it's unconditional in that it will be fulfilled to Abraham. But that doesn't mean that every Jewish person is going to be saved, because not every Jewish person exhibits faith in God. So it's only the blessings of the covenant only come to those who adhere to the stipulations of the covenant. But the guarantee is that there will be a remnant who does adhere. There will be a nation, and the nation will live in the land. Okay? That's the guarantee. Yes. Many people, yes, today there's a two-covenant theory going out that Jewish people are saved just because they have a covenant with Abraham, and that is not true. And witness to the Jewish people is being stunted in the church by saying they don't need Jesus. It's another way of salvation, and that's not true at all. Exactly. Okay. So the Abrahamic covenant will be fulfilled, but that doesn't mean that every Jewish person that's ever existed is going to experience it that. Okay? All right, I'm a little over, so we brought the book of Micah to a close. We'll pick up next hour with Nahum. So go take your break. 15.